This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Edgar Kellogg is a man in a bit of a crisis. He quit his lucrative job as a lawyer to become a journalist, and he's a little clueless about how to do that. But a lucky break gets him posted to a fictional foreign country called Barba. That's where a terrorist organization called SOB has captured the world's attention. Edgar has to fill the shoes of a larger-than-life reporter named Barrington Sadler. The novel is called The New Republic. It's the latest release from Lionel Shriver. It is out now. Lionel Shriver, one-time resident of Raleigh, joins us by phone to talk about her new book. Welcome, Lionel.
Hi. It's nice to talk to you.
It's good to talk with you. This book was written or finished, I guess, in 1998. Here we are in 2012. What took so long to get it out?
I don't know. Spelling mistake?
They didn't have spell check back then, did they?
They were just coming on, and believe me, I need them. I did try to get it published in 98, but I didn't get any takers, and I think there are two reasons for that. One of them's obvious. My sales record was dreadful, and I don't want to sound whiny because I think that publishers are not charities, and I wasn't making anybody money, so I don't really blame them. But the other reason's more interesting, and that is that in that time, the subject of terrorism just wasn't interesting to American readerships. It didn't seem to pertain to American culture. Essentially, my subject matter was a big bore.
Yeah, and that's amazing. I mean, say that again. Remember the time when terrorism was boring and not terribly interesting or relevant.
Most of all, it seemed irrelevant,
yeah.
Which is a little peculiar because there, you know, we'd had that first attack on the World Trade Center, and then there was Oklahoma.
Right.
But I think they still seemed like aberrations, and, you know, the world that was to come hadn't happened yet.
Right. So we gave a brief outline of the plot in the introduction. Fill us in a little bit more.
Well, of course, my sales record improved because I went on to write another book, We Need to Talk About Kevin, and that did very well. Just came out as a film this year.
Yeah.
So that would have opened the gateway to publishing this book at long last. Unfortunately, something else had happened at the same time, and that's 9/11. And I'm afraid... you know, I thought about it. I thought about publishing this because, you know, suddenly I had a manuscript ready to go that was about the hottest topic in the United States. But I really couldn't do it because the book is funny. And I worried that a light touch would have been interpreted as in poor taste.
So you had to find that right moment, and I guess the moment is now to publish this book. And it is funny, but it also it's a serious look at terrorism and its relationship with journalism. It's funny and it's lighthearted, but it's a very serious subject, and I think a very serious look.
Yes, I wouldn't ever want that sense of humor in the book to be misinterpreted, because it's not a book that takes terrorism lightly.
Right.
And so that it's not joking about terrorism. It's a book that takes the issue very seriously. And it's trying to make a serious point, but, you know, it's a candy-coated serious point. I hope it's a fun book. It reads very quickly. But it's making the observation that whether we like it or not, terrorism works. It's been extremely effective. And I saw that at close hand in my 12 years living in Belfast.
I think what you highlight in this book, or what worked for me, was in demonstrating the way terrorism works and the way terrorism is a kind of mirror image of the society that it's trying to bring down, to attack. And so there's this relationship, a kind of mirror relationship in the characters. Edgar Kellogg, a man haunted first in high school by a larger-than-life guy in high school, and then posted to a place where he's also having to live in the shadow of the reporter he placed there. Here's a guy always looking in the mirror and never quite measuring up.
Yes, well, a lot of my books tend to take on more than one issue at a time, usually a larger social issue, and in this case, of course, terrorism, but also a personal one, something more intimate. And in this case, it's this proclivity of my protagonist for falling in love, and I don't mean romantically. It's he becomes infatuated with people, other men, who seem to embody everything that he would like to be. You know, men with flair, with social aplomb, people whom other people admire, who are always the social center of any gathering. And I think we all know what I'm talking about, the charismatic character. And there are such people, and it's a little mysterious what makes them that way. The irony in the novel is that while Edgar is embarrassed by this proclivity of his and believes that it's a terrible weakness, it's actually the most charming thing about him.
And it's precisely this envy. I mean, I do think that the relationship between these men and these people whose lives we're looking at, and the way terrorism works, the way envy becomes a kind of the energy that keeps terrorists going, and the people who report on them.
Yes, there's a playful interrelationship between these two seemingly very disparate issues. After all, Osama bin Laden was a charismatic character, wasn't he? In fact, a lot of terrorist movements are led by people who are compelling personally.
Tell us a little bit more about the plot now. Edgar does leave this job. He's doing well as an attorney, decides to become a journalist because that high school friend of his seemed to have a romantic job as a journalist. That's the first thing that happens. Give us a little more of the plot.
Well, the plot hinges on a revelation in the middle of the book, which I'm not going to give away because I think it ruins the reading experience. Right. But I will say that the book is not what it seems for the first half.
There's a twist. But Edgar goes and he's posted to this place called Barba, and he is supposed to cover the SOB, which his predecessor, Barrington Sadler, has covered quite successfully. He can't get out of the shadow of Barrington. What is it about this relationship, do you think, because I think this is also sort of one of the themes in the book, mm-hmm. the relationship between journalism and terrorism?
I'm afraid the relationship is quite intimate. And this is a point of real frustration for me because I don't know what the answer is. I believe that terrorists in general are motivated to get attention. I guess a lot of us are. It's not a desire which is necessarily wicked. After all, people who are striving to win the Nobel Peace Prize or to cure cancer also want a kind of attention. But these days, especially with an international and internet media at our disposal, it's easy for us to amplify the negative. And if you want attention, it's a lot easier to get attention by doing something bad than by achieving something. And that means that we are constantly furnishing exactly what terrorists want, that kind of intensity of attention. And one of the points that the book makes is that it doesn't really matter if that attention is negative. In fact, when you spend a lot of time deploring these people and saying how terrible it is, you're still giving them what they want. You're still putting them at the center of the universe. And there's an interesting parallel here with a subject that I went on to write about, and we need to talk about Kevin, and that is that lower-order terrorist, the school shooter. They're universally motivated by the same thing. It's this desire to see their name in lights. Mm. And again, it doesn't matter if it's surrounded by opprobrium, but it makes other people concerned with your agenda, even examining what terrible problems you had in high school. And it's the same with terrorists. We end up examining what it is that, say, Islamic terrorists want? What is it about their lives that they're unhappy about? That's what we're paying attention to. And the press is what generates this attention. And when I say I don't know what the answer is, it's because I don't believe in censorship.
Right.
So I don't want to say, because we believe that all this press attention is actually inspiring more of the same, so you can't cover that bombing or
right.
You can't cover that school shooting. I don't want to do that. But I am frustrated that, for example, I've participated in providing that kind of attention myself. There were several years that I was constantly contacted to give my opinion about every school shooting that came along. I was supposedly some kind of an expert.
Right.
And at a certain point, I stopped giving those interviews because I felt I was becoming part of the problem. I was providing exactly the attention that these kids want.
That talks about the analysis after the fact, though, that the censorship nobody wants to see is on the coverage of the event itself. This thing happened, here's how many people were hurt, and here's where the investigation is. And then the question is, are we going to take a look at, the psychology of the school shooter, the demands of the terrorist, the conditions of people who are living under, in this situation, or something else? And that seems to be, is that where you would say we should be more careful about our coverage?
As I say, I don't know what the answer
yeah.
is. Because then there's a natural public appetite to understand why something happened. And that's going to lead you into all kinds of self-examination and plumbing the background story, trying to come to some understanding. And I'm sympathetic with that, especially as a novelist and as a public commentator, I'm very sympathetic with that desire. I feel it myself. And the media is naturally going to feed that appetite.
Interesting, though, that this thirst for attention is precisely Edgar's problem, albeit you say his most charming quality, and what feeds Sarah.
I think the thirst for attention is not his most charming quality. But I think that his tendency to admire other people
isn't
very appealing.
Isn't he admiring them, though, because they're the ones who get all the attention? No?
Yes, of course. He wants attention, but I think his problem is he doesn't realize that being the fan, the experience of admiring, is actually a richer one than being admired. I've occasionally had the experience of being admired myself, and I frankly find it confusing and befuddling and a little embarrassing.
Why is that?
Whereas finding someone else whom I revere is delightful.
Well, why is that? Why do you find it confusing and befuddling?
I think if you know yourself very well, there's always a sense of being undeserving
mm-hmm.
of a certain degree of admiration because I know lots of things that are wrong with me.
You know the stuff your readers don't know.
There's that sense of being a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things that the novel examines is not only the experience of Edgar being the fan, but it also looks at what it's like to be the person whom everyone reveres and how lonely that can be.
Well,
and how it often does make you feel as if you're a fake.
And there can be some objective standards by which you can be called a fake, things that you claim to have done that you didn't, et cetera. But then there's the other problem that maybe you have when you feel uncomfortable is that people are projecting onto you stuff that you never claimed and you don't know how they got that idea. Is that part
exactly.
of it?
Exactly. And that's the problem with being an icon of any kind. And one of the things I never envy celebrities because it's a process of projection. It's often a very, that admiration, especially in adulthood, is usually mixed with a lot of envy.
Mm-hmm.
And the envy is acidic. And that's not a pleasant emotion to be subjected to.
Where did the idea for this book come from?
It was primarily from my experience of living in Northern Ireland. But I had already written my third novel, set in Northern Ireland, and I certainly didn't want to repeat that. Not only do I not like to repeat myself, period, but by then, I've been there over 10 years, and I loved the place, but I was so sick of the politics. And there was no way I wanted to set another book there. But I did feel that this theme of how terrorism pays off I had failed to explore in my previous book. And so that when I got the idea that I refused to give away the twist, which is really the center of this book, I thought, yes, I have to do that, but I have to remove it from Northern Ireland, which is, of course, very polarizing and divisive and had grown horribly tedious. So I made a place up. I drew a peninsula on the bottom of Portugal. You'll see a map in the book itself, and you might compare it sometime to the real map of Portugal, and you'll see that there's a little beard drawn onto it. And I really enjoyed the experience of making a place up. It meant that I could create a local, really disgusting fruit that they brew disgusting beer out of.
with a delightful name, I should add.
Oh, the hairy pear.
The hairy pear. I mean, who?
And hairy pear beer.
Yeah.
In fact, the Australian edition of this book has created a hairy pear in the middle of the cover.
Of course, they've probably already brewed the beer. But go ahead.
And the concept of this place is that it's just, you know, it's the armpit of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I chose Portugal in particular because it's on the outer edges of Europe, and is poorer than most of Europe, and is something of an outback already. So this is the outback of the outback. And I'm pleased that I say terrible things about Barbara, but I think you can say anything you want about a place that doesn't exist. And after all, in the book, people in the rest of Portugal despise this province and can't stand the people who live there. And so that bit was fun. I mean, that's what I mean when I say that the book is written with a light touch. It's inventive, it's playful. Yeah.
Well, and when this book takes off, no doubt there's a town in Portugal that will change its name just to attract the tourist, I'm sure.
Right.
Tell us about this habit of yours now, because we need to talk about Kevin suffered somewhat from the same fate as New Republic, in the sense that people felt the subject area that you dealt with was just too sensitive. There's no way we can talk about this kind of a thing, a child shooter. It's too much, and you had a hard time selling it. Now terrorism, not quite serious enough, and then too serious a subject for your book. And yet, in the end, something that we really want to read about, that become powerful books that do reflect something that's on our mind. What's wrong with you, Lionel? Why can't you get it right? Why can't your books come out on time?
Well, I did find that in this particular instance, it was a lesson in how it doesn't ever pay to be ahead of your time.
There you go. Wonderful book, Lionel. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Lionel Shriver's latest novel, The New Republic. She will appear at Quail Ridge Books and Music tonight at 7:30. Just ahead, find out what you're missing when you go into the woods when we preview a new book, The Forest Unseen. Stay tuned.